and welcome to the Innovation Forum podcast for Friday 17th of January with me, Ian Welsh. Earlier this week, I spoke with Jo Griffiths, Global Food Community Director for the British Standards Institute, or BSI, about her work developing standards for packaging. Our discussion focused inevitably on plastic, as you'll hear shortly. Also coming up are highlights of a conversation I had with Don Jutla, founder of blockchain technology developers Peer Ledger, about the benefits of supply chain traceability. But first is the regular roundup of some sustainable business news. For the first time, the World Economic Forum's annual risks report, released ahead of the Davos meeting, says that the top five risks in terms of likelihood in the next 10 years are all environment or climate related, including extreme weather events and natural disasters, failure of climate change mitigation and adaptation by governments and businesses, and major biodiversity loss. And in his annual letter to CEOs, Larry Fink, boss of the world's largest asset manager, BlackRock, talks of a fundamental reshaping of finance, saying that companies must ratchet up efforts to tackle climate change or face anger from investors about how unsustainable practices might curb future wealth. BlackRock will, Fink says, be increasingly disposed to cast critical votes at company annual general meetings based on climate action. The firm had been under some pressure from climate activists to back up its green rhetoric, and BlackRock has just recently joined Climate Action 100 Plus, a group of asset managers that push the largest producers of fossil fuels to show how they will meet carbon dioxide reduction targets. Notably, Vanguard, the second largest asset manager, has so far declined to sign up to Climate Action 100 Plus, saying that it prefers to focus on engagement with companies rather than voting for action. The EU has unveiled a 1 trillion euro plan to target climate change, with the aim of making the bloc carbon neutral by 2050. The plan would mean that 25% of the EU's budget would be dedicated to achieving carbon neutrality, with funds allocated to a mechanism to help member states still heavily reliant on coal for energy, such as Poland. The incoming European Commission has seemingly made a Green Deal a core part of its new strategy. The mechanism to enable transition to carbon neutrality would allocate funds to EU regions to re-skill workers in the coal and other fossil fuel sectors. The allocation would be dependent on member states submitting plans for climate-friendly economic restructure. Also reflecting a definite growing trend, brewing giant AB InBev has just announced a 10-year agreement to power all of its Western European production facilities with 100% renewable energy. Power generator BYRE will develop two new large solar farms in Spain, generating 250 gigawatt hours of electricity each year from March 2022. Already, AB InBev had secured 100% renewable energy for its UK operations in December 2018. The pros and cons of different types of packaging continues to be in the spotlight, not least the unintended consequences of simply switching from plastic because that's what the public seems to want. A new report from London-based think tank Green Alliance says that leading UK supermarkets and food and drink brands don't consider the full impact of alternatives to plastics when making this switch. The report, titled Plastics Promises, includes interviews with five leading retailers and five brands and reveals that environmental credentials of new materials are not always considered. Supermarkets, Morrisons, Tesco and Sainsbury's have all switched from single-use plastic bags to paper alternatives, but the paper bags take four times as much energy to manufacture. Companies are boasting about coming out of plastic, but no public debate about the impacts of single-use alternatives occurs. The companies interviewed by Green Alliance call for more strategic direction and intervention from government to align the debate on carbon and prevent unintended increases in overall environmental damage in a bid to cut plastic pollution. A report from non-profit Planet Tracker highlights the deforestation impact of the shrimp sector on mangroves, framing it as a risk that the $45 billion global shrimp market cannot afford to ignore. The Shell Shock report says that 30% of the mangrove deforestation and other coastal land use change in Southeast Asia has been attributed to shrimp farming. And Planet Tracker identifies 27 companies worth $102 billion involved in the shrimp sector, potentially at risk from the deforestation impacts of the sector, as well as regulatory change and other constraints. Shell Shock argues that none of the investors in these businesses are reporting about risks from mangrove deforestation or other emissions related to the shrimp sector. Finally this week, while the rise of meat alternatives continues, UK-based meat-free pioneer Quorn has announced it will introduce carbon labelling on its products. Designed to help consumers unpick the impact of the products they buy, labels will appear on some products in the next few months and across the entire range by 2021. The labels will include information favourably comparing the footprint of the fungi-based protein in corn with that of beef. The carbon impact is around 90% lower. The start of Innovation Forum's 2020 conference programme is only 2 months away. On the 18th and 19th of March, we'll be back in London for the Ethical Trade and Human Rights Forum. Among the confirmed speakers are business experts from L'Oréal, Mondelez International, AB InBev, Total, Fairtrade and Freshfields. Our New York Human Rights and Business event is on the 5th and 6th of May. If you come along, you'll hear from senior representatives at Walmart, Microsoft, Intel, PepsiCo, Hilton, Tyson Foods and Timberland. On the 28th and 29th of April, we'll be back in Amsterdam for the next in our Sustainable Apparel and Textiles conference series. Among the experts joining us then will be representatives of Primark, Hugo Boss, Tommy Hilfiger, CNA, Aileen Fisher, Sustainable Apparel Coalition and Conservation International. And you can save €300 if you register for the conference before close on 17th of January. And we will be convening the 2020 Future of Food US Forum in Minneapolis on the 27th and 28th of May, and be hearing from the likes of Walmart, Danone, General Mills, Yum Brands, Kellogg and McCain. And joining us at the London Future of Food event on the 2nd and 3rd of June will be the key people from Unilever, Nestle, Korn, Sime Darby, IKEA, Oxfam and Tiger Brands. Recently, I spoke with Don Jutla, founder and co-CEO of blockchain and traceability specialist Peer Ledger, about how technology is revolutionising consumer engagement with products and their supply chains. Peer Ledger develops blockchain-style ledger traceability solutions. Don, what are the key challenges for adapting this sort of technology for agriculture value chains?
So it's an old IT project, and challenges start at the leadership level. You know, are leaders being responsible? Are they responsive to change? It's a real challenge when some agri leaders act in a blasé manner towards sustainability. As an example, I'll give you one. Is it responsible sourcing if a corporation responsibly sources 20% of their beans from farmers who they track? And let's say the other 80% from conventional sources, but yet they say on their chocolate wrappers that they have 100% responsibly sourced beans. And so as long as corporate leaders think that's okay, this is a challenge to honestly communicating with consumers. And consumers and corporations are saying that they would like to be able to communicate their values to each other, particularly around sustainability. So the next challenge also is in a leadership category where senior management must be willing to fund physical segregation for traceability technologies to work at the processing level in particular. So if companies get beans, let's say from conventional sources like we spoke about, and the rest from track sources, and if they can keep those separate, then it means that we would be able to have the traceability throughout the system. So that's a barrier to full traceability from source to consumer, and that happens at the processing layer. What we realized there is, of course, to do physical segregation, to do binning, to even enter information into a record-keeping system. So a system of record as the blockchain means that there is overhead and some additional cost. Will companies be willing to undertake those additional costs? And so that's a particular challenge, again, for traceability. In a sense, see some corporations who are doubling down on this technology because I think they're aware of that consumer trend where consumers care about the corporation's social value, they care in terms of where they put their purchasing dollars. And so we are getting some traction in the more forward-looking corporations at this point. So those are two leadership challenges right there. And then, of course, we've got challenges to ensure at the blockchain application level itself that there is a matching to the business requirements. This sounds just like an IT technology, right, at this point. So I'll give you an example of one of those. In agri-food in particular, it's necessary to track at various granularities, at lot level tracing, unit level tracing, bulk level tracing, for example. So that's another area. Another area in the traceability application, and this is not unique to blockchain, this would be true to any technology that you use to do traceability, is whether you can trust the integrity of the upstream sustainability information that's coming onto your platform. What we've been saying to people is that even though blockchain is a trust machine, you still need auxiliary trust mechanisms to complement it. So the monitoring and the audits that are done at upstream for controls all the way through, they're still needed. So this technology does not take that away. However, what it does create a lot of efficiencies. The fact that you have a single truth, that golden truth, it creates efficiencies in itself because it removes a whole lot of the reconciliation costs that would come along with fragmented information. So those are some of the key challenges that we see.
I mean, I guess we're thinking in terms of changing corporate culture in many respects and also getting around cost concerns that businesses may have before implementing this, as for any IT project. So thinking more specifically then, what are the characteristics of supply chains where this type of solution is most useful?
All types of supply chains will benefit, as most can improve with respect to managing their sustainability risk, right? According to EcoVadis, for example, less than 10% of companies have executive insight into the magnitude of CSR, or corporate social responsibility risk, deep in their supply chains. Companies tend to lack the means for speedy risk responses and, to some extent, 100% regulatory compliance. And what we're seeing in agribusiness in particular is that one high-value use case in blockchain food traceability is the ability to do rapid recalls or rapid response. And even with ERPs, people take days to get a trace, whereas with blockchain, the entities involved in recall can be identified and communicated to in seconds.
Well, that's certainly a great example of how blockchain can help. Are you seeing from your work consumer pressures in action here? And can blockchain-type solutions allow consumers the product transparency that they seem to be demanding?
Absolutely. We're starting to see the signs. For years, the surveys have been saying that consumers would prefer to buy sustainably sourced goods or responsibly sourced goods. There's always a chasm between what people say and what they actually do. But recently, with the blockchain pilots that have been going out there, we're collecting real data on how people behave. And so Carrefour's pilot, for example, they reported out of it within the last year that consumers bought more of their blockchain food than their non-blockchain food. And so we're starting to see consumers put their money where their mouth is. We also saw reports around over $8 billion that was spent ethically produced food in the UK within the last year. This is more than a trend. This is actual behavior. And I think that the agri-food companies are absolutely zoning in on this. And so we start to see the farmer apps and tip the farmer apps, etc. And again, that's consumer interacting directly with the sources of the ingredients that go into the products that they're purchasing. So in that case, there is, you can see transparency happening throughout that value chain. So this is something we believe that there will be great growth in. I attended a sales sustainability conference recently, and every single big company that was there talked about their wanting to speak more to their consumers, to make their consumers more aware of their social values and what they're doing and for responsibility in their supply chain.
That's certainly a trend that we are seeing at Innovation Forum as well. Given that consumers are increasingly demanding transparency, is it possible for complex supply chains, which include processing stages, can they ever be totally traceable?
So again, this comes back to the willingness for the processors to segregate the produce that's coming into their businesses. Our solution, for example, Mimosi, we can track four types of transformation. We can track if you have multiple inputs coming in to a transformation process. So let's say you're making a salsa. You get multiple sources of tomatoes from many farms. And you may have onions and cilantro, peppers, whatever else, secret ingredients you might put in your salsa. So there are multiple inputs coming into the salsa. And then you're making tons of bottles of the salsa, let's say. And so it's multiple input, multiple output. What a blockchain application like ours can do is that we can record the produce that came from various farms that went into the making of at a unit level or a lot level, or in this case, bulk won't suit, but lot level or at unit level, exactly what went into the product that consumers are buying. And what I'm saying is that we're not only tracking at a multiple input, multiple output, like the salsa example, but we can also track it if you have multiple inputs going into a process, but only one output or one input coming out and many outputs. Like, for example, you chop something up and you have a lot of output, or even a single output, but there's some added value that goes into the process. To be able to track at that level, it means that at the factory floor, people must be willing to segregate the materials that are coming in. Bin the ones that you know come from farm A, bin the ones that came from farm B, and segregate them. And so that's the big challenge for us, is when the processors are willing to do it at that level, we will have true end-to-end traceability.
What sort of incentives need to be in place for that factory then to overcome reluctance in putting these extra stages in the processing?
I think with respect to the processors themselves, it would be that they want to keep their brand promises. It becomes well known, let's say, to the consumers that this is a particular bottleneck. And so there may be pressure coming from the consumers as well. So from the leadership level for the processors, and then from the consumer level too. And then there may be some regulatory pressures coming in, because every FDA type agency, or CFIA, so in Canada, it's the Canadian Food Inspection Agency, and in the UK, and you have the equivalent in the EU as well, there will be pressures around fixing broken traceability systems. And there are good reasons for it. Sometimes there are political reasons. It is a fact that if one of these countries lead to say that you should have an up and end down traceability, all the other countries will do so as well, because they're connected in terms of wanting a brand for the food that they export and import, particularly the food that they export. So they want a brand for the food that they export. So it's a national brand. If you know that you have high quality food coming from the UK because of this extra trust layer that you put on with blockchain, then likely the sales would increase to whatever your importing country is. So that's a political pressure. The reasons why these agencies will look at blockchain in the first place, the big, big reason is around safety. The fact that they can save lives likely in an outbreak, if they can very quickly identify where the contaminated materials have traveled to, and they can communicate quickly with parties involved so that they can save lives.
The role of government is always fascinating. Are you seeing a move on the part of governments to require by law greater traceability in supply chains?
What we're seeing are consultations. It's the start of the process. As you know, government won't just mandate something like that. They would need to consult with all their stakeholders. And so the consultations have started. There are champions in governments everywhere, at least the ones that we've been speaking to in Canada and the US, UK, lots of the European countries, etc., for adopting an up and end down traceability. But of course, that's not going to happen unless all the consultations with the stakeholders are complete.
Can you give us an example of how a traceability solution can work in practice? An example, perhaps, of a value chain where there are benefits for everyone from consumer to producer.
Blockchain traceability solutions basically should trace only what companies wish them to track. The big thing about this is that you can have track and trace across different companies in a supply chain. So as you say, across the value chain stakeholders. If employees can visualize the dependencies in the supply chain in seconds, that's useful. Companies can act to manage risk, as in issuing a speedy comprehensive recall, as we've spoken about. That's useful. Companies can associate documents with their traceability transactions, so sustainability documents, for example, with their materials and their items, can make it visible to the entire value chain. That's useful. You may have document level tracking as well as physical level tracking, because you have the IoT technologies and the RFID and technologies and so forth. If companies can retrieve transactions in seconds and save time, useful. They will be able to prove their responsible sourcing claims all the way through the value chain. They give customers visibility into the entire supply chain, as we've spoken about. That's valuable too. And so our interviews with industry experts in food and minerals, they say that the lack of traceability in systems today does not only affect corporations, but like you said, it affects the entire ecosystem. And at the start of the value chain, at environments and disadvantaged populations in developing countries, and start of many value chains, these environments and populations are susceptible to abuses when there is a lack of transparency, as exists today in many, many supply chains. Palm oil is the poster child for this. Blockchain traceability will open up that transparency throughout supply chains. In addition, at the logistic provider level in the value chain, we see for that particular provider that there is an incentive using blockchain with different smart contracts, for example, where they can get paid faster, where reconciliation costs are taken out of their system. So there's an incentive for them to go on. And they're important to be on because they can independently validate the quantity of production that has gone between two parties. Again, adding trust. If consumers become unsure of product quality, when their social values are not satisfied, they can easily look for alternative products. It's a serious trend that the food industry cannot ignore. And governments, when you think about the value within the ecosystem, they want faster recalls and investigations. They want to reduce food waste and absolutely better insight into supply chain risk with an emphasis on prevention of harms, as we've spoken about.
Well, thank you. It does seem that the potential for blockchain-type technologies is huge, and it's going to be fascinating to see how it all unfolds over the coming months and years. But for now, Dawn Jatla from Peer Ledger, thank you very much.
Thank you, Ian. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Next up is an interview I did with Joe Griffiths, Global Food Community Director at the British Standards Institute. We talked about the challenges in developing sustainability standards for packaging, particularly in the midst of the hyped-up debate about the use of plastics. Why don't you give us an outline of what BSI is trying to achieve, particularly in packaging, which I know is a focus area for you?
Well, packaging's for a long time been seen as wasteful and also been a recent upsurge in a dislike of plastics in particular. And what's not necessarily understood is that packaging's got a real strong role in supply chains, not just for food, but for all products. There's virtually no product you can buy that hasn't been transported in some type of packaging, whether that be primary or consumer packaging, secondary or bulk packaging, or tertiary transport packaging like pallets and so on. And it's the interaction of these different types of packaging is that what gets our conflicts to our kitchen cupboards. And supply chains are increasingly complex. Our fruit and vegetables are as likely to be imported as they are to be locally produced. So the packaging needs to be effective as possible to minimise waste, not just the food itself, but all the resources that have gone into producing it. So if we can use our understanding of the role of packaging and our knowledge of how to reuse resources as effectively as possible, then perhaps we can make packaging more sustainable and our supply chains more sustainable.
How do you define sustainable packaging?
Well, it's difficult to define, I think. I don't think there's necessarily an agreed definition of sustainable that works for every industry. But for me, and in the discussions I've had with people, and in the workshop we ran in October, it was acknowledging and working within the circular economy. So the circular economy is a phrase that's perhaps gaining greater recognition that we must move towards that type of approach. But there's little mechanism to enable people. There's no clear how. But there's actually already a standard developed by BSI, and circularity is something we can define. So that's defined within that standard as an economy that's restorative and regenerative by design, and which aims to keep products, components, and materials at their highest utility and value at all times. So this recognises that we should reframe waste as a resource and understand how we can use it. But bigger than that, we should design things in a way that supports their future use rather than disposal. And that goes for plastic packaging as much as it does for building materials and for products. So we may see a simplification in materials used in packaging to prevent contamination when it's reprocessed. If you only have three plastics in use and you've removed those that are difficult to recycle, then reprocessing them becomes much more simple and justifies investment in facilities and infrastructure to do that reprocessing or facilitate the reuse of the material. And that's exactly what the Plastics Pact from the Waste and Resources Action Programme, RAP, is targeting. Then there's the old stalwart, ISO 14001, and that's the Environmental Management System standard. And that's now, I think, in its third or fourth iteration. And that standard enables organisations to assess their environmental impacts. So I believe it's between these two, between ISO 14001, an auditable standard that engenders a systems approach to managing environmental impacts as the baseline, and the use of BS 8001, circular economy, a guideline for companies to achieve circular economy as the mechanism for organisational shift. It's between those two that sustainability around packaging and indeed products lies.
What are the difficulties then in establishing standards that work cross-sector?
The scale and really where to start, scope is really important. We must be careful to define what needs to be done, what can be done in order to support circularity. And I think the most recent workshop started to help us determine the first steps. And some of that is around defining what words mean within the sustainability debate. Words like sustainables, let's understand what that really means across different sectors for different actors in that sector. And also words like compostable and biodegradable, then we can start to assess the role of each of them through further work. And education, of course, is key.
So then you're developing standards specifically for sustainable packaging. Are there specific challenges you've found in developing those standards?
We're really at very early stages on that. We're starting to have the discussions with people to see what their key challenges are and what's inhibiting them from taking steps towards what might be considered as more sustainable. So as I was saying, that even just defining what sustainable means for packaging, what sustainable means within global supply chains, what roles different types of materials have in that supply chain, it's hugely complex. Our global supply chains are hugely complex. We import so much product from different parts of the world, and no matter where you are in the world, you know, in the UK we import so much food. In North America, again, there's a lot of importing, and a lot of our products come from areas that we don't perhaps think about that the products come from. So if we can sort of start to understand the complex challenges, and only by having discussions with different types of stakeholders like retailers and academia and government to see what each of the unique set of challenges are for each of those parties, then we can start to bring people together, have the discussions and say, right, okay, we are here, where do we want to get to and how do we get there?
The debate around packaging has become focused on plastics in particular. And that's why we're having this conversation, if you like, because so many people now are concerned and debating the use of plastic in packaging. So to what extent do you think that the debate around plastic has become too polarized? Is there a need for re-education about why and when plastic is essential? I mean, there are instances where it is essential, right?
You're right, it is hugely polarised. It feels very weighted towards being anti-plastics, but there are some seeds of thinking about how plastic supports the circular economy and to reduce food waste. And of course, that's why packaging exists, to protect products in transit, and food is so important. The role of packaging is to protect food so it's edible when we receive it, to preserve it so it's undamaged, to contain the quantity we want, and to inform the consumers, us as consumers, so we know what's inside the package. And marketing has really turned packaging into the art form, into the silent salesman. We should be focusing on food waste as well. In the UK, we waste 30% of all the food produced. And if we could remove that waste, then that's 30% less land and water required to grow food and ingredients. That's 30% less transport and logistics required. And of course, we're aware of the impact of logistics on the environment through greenhouse gas emissions. And of course, it represents a reduction in household food budgets. And in some parts of the world, that waste level of food is up to 40 or 50%. And that level of wastage is completely unacceptable when you consider that some people are forced to go to bed hungry, even within developed nations. But we focus on plastics, I believe, because it's so very tangible. We are all consumers and we're global citizens, and we see and feel and deal with this stuff on a daily basis. And we're forced to accept how much we consume and how much waste we produce. So no wonder we have a problem with it. And now we have awareness of just how much waste ends up in our environment, and it feels inescapable. And I think it's no surprise that culturally there are trends around minimalism, the discarding of excess belongings in order to appreciate what we keep. We want to keep our world. We want to appreciate the world we're in. And perhaps we're sort of thinking more about discarding what we feel as excess in order to maintain our world in the way that we want to appreciate it.
How can standards then help the food sector avoid moving from a plastics problem to an even worse food waste problem?
Again, it's increasingly complex, as there is a real danger that companies move away from plastics to other materials without thinking longer term and understanding the impacts that those changes will have, that a knee-jerk reaction. There are products now that used to be in plastic bottles, in PET, polyethylene terephthalate. It's an incredibly recyclable material with lots of resources, with lots of infrastructure to manage that material. And there's a PP cap, also polypropylene, also incredibly recyclable. And those products are now in paper containers, or what look like paper containers, which we think are good because it's recyclable, right? Paper's recyclable. But that paper is laminated, it's coated in plastic, and laminated materials are so much more difficult to recycle. And ultimately, plastics is a victim of its own success. It's so good at what it does, and we can't move away from it. It's too embedded now in how we operate as global economies. When it first arrived, it was marketed as a disposable material, but our ability to forget to assess the longer-term impact of those actions of disposal has caught up with us. And we know there's a lack of infrastructure for reprocessing recycling. We're aware of that even in developed economies like the UK and Europe. We know that the recycling system is creaking under the weight of the volume of stuff that's going into it, and there's perhaps a lack of focus, or a historical lack of focus, on building infrastructure. Transparency from social media, and of course conventional media, allows us for the first time to be confronted by scenes of developing countries who have this stuff seemingly dumped on them as well, who simply don't have any infrastructure at all to manage that material and the volume that's produced. So I strongly believe that we don't need to change materials. We need to think more of the materials we do use to realise their value. And I think that's something that things like the deposit return system that Scotland are proposing, something that does, it starts to attach a monetary value to that empty plastic bottle. And that's a subtle message, and which starts to mean that we see plastic as a useful material, and it's so useful that industry wants it back so they can do something else amazing with it. So if we in standards can start to take those theories and embed them into a global norm, then that means that people can adhere to a commonality, which means we're all moving in the same direction.
So you're developing a standard or standards that recognises that the food sector needs to avoid increasing environmental impact from a switch away from plastic to alternatives.
Absolutely. And it's not necessarily about auditing someone to say, yes, that is or is not sustainable. I mentioned BS 8001 earlier. That's a standard that BSI has developed that talks around the circular economy. But it's not auditable. It's actually a guideline. So this standard or suite of standards really starts to give people tools and mechanisms by which to make cultural changes in their organization about how they design products and how a different way of thinking can help people understand that packaging's got that role in the supply chain to prevent waste. You know, it's part of the solution, not part of the problem.
What's the time frame for developing these standards?
That's a tough one. It's a big job. I think there's a lot to do. There's a lot of talking to be done. There's a lot of discussions and a lot of engagement to be done with brand owners and retailers and supply chain actors. You know, logistics and supply chain is fundamental to engage because virtually all of our products are transported in some way. So we need to engage every single aspect of the supply chain. That takes time. We've got very good relationships as a standards builder with lots of different aspects of supply chains. It's our job to make sure that the discussions are held. It's difficult to put a time frame on it, but certainly we acknowledge timeframes within things like the UN SDGs and also the Plastics Pact that's been developed by RAP, because what we want to do is enable the whole supply chain, not just brand owners and retailers, but the whole supply chain to move towards a solution, to move towards a point where they can say, yes, we embed those concepts within how we operate as a business.
Thinking more broadly then, what's driving this process for BSI and how does it fit into your other programmes?
Well, we actually have a mandate. We were incorporated by Royal Charter in 1901, so we're nearly 120 years old. Our purpose at that point was to drive solutions to practical problems. This is our job. Our mandate tells us that we coordinate the efforts of experts to determine what good looks like, to build consensus and agreement that we all move forward in the same way. And we can produce tangible practical outcomes, the how of circularity, the tools to help businesses legitimise their practices. And our food and retail sector is about having those conversations around the world, the right people talking about the right things to create those practical solutions that work globally. Any issue we face within the sector is a global issue because our supply chains are, so the solutions need to be the same. We're also working on other topics such as alternative proteins, those things like cultured proteins, insect proteins, plant-based, the authenticity of food, food safety culture, and modern slavery or forced labour within the community. And anyone who's interested in contributing to the discussion should connect with me.
And how can you do that, Jo? I guess you're on Twitter and all the usual social media.
Best way is through LinkedIn. Search my name, Joanna Griffiths, at BSI.
It's a lot of exciting work going on with you guys at BSI. But for now, Jo Griffiths, Global Foods Community Director with the BSI. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Remember that there is plenty of content available online at innovationforum.co.uk. All available for free, of course. No paywalls at Innovation Forum. But that's all for this week. Do get in touch if there's anything you want us to cover in the coming weeks and months. You can find me in the usual places, including Twitter and LinkedIn, or via Innovation Forum. For now, though, I've been Ian Welsh, and we'll be back next week.